The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable John W. Turner presiding.
Thank you. Good morning. We're here on case number 4220677. That's People versus Brian K. Williams. For the appellant, we have Maria Shaver. For the appellee, Mr. Justin Nicolosi. Ms. Shaver, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you. May it please the court, good morning. On behalf of the Office of the State Appellate Defender, my name is Mariah Shaver and I represent Brian Williams. The central error in this case that caused or contributed to all three issues before this court occurred when the trial court failed to admonish Brian Williams until after accepting his guilty plea that it was not concurring in or bound by the agreed 33-year sentencing cap and that it could in fact sentence Brian anywhere from 12 to 120 years. Then, after finally disclosing that information, the court never told Brian he could either persist in or withdraw that plea as Rule 402d3 required. Our Supreme Court enacted Rule 402 to ensure guilty pleas are knowingly and voluntarily made, but as a result of the court's failure to properly admonish Brian, he received the maximum potential sentence of 120 years after pleading guilty without knowing that was even possible. The protective measures intended to prevent things like this from happening failed Brian on multiple levels. Even if Brian is not entitled to relief due to the trial court's failure to substantially comply with Rule 402d3, the inadequate admonishments resulted in Brian pleading guilty while under the misapprehension that he could not be sentenced beyond the 33-year cap and that he could not withdraw his plea once he learned that he had pled guilty while under multiple misapprehensions. And if Brian is not permitted to withdraw his plea, he should be allowed to challenge his 120-year sentence that, again, as a result of not being properly admonished, he did not even know could be imposed at the time he pled guilty. When the trial court ordered Brian to serve a sentence 87 years beyond the agreed cap, the plea transformed into an open plea for purposes of Rule 604D. The core issue with Brian's plea is that the errors caused by the court's failure to substantially comply with Rule 402D3 were never cured and then snowballed into a host of other problems, all of which could have been avoided if the court had simply followed the rule or answered Brian's questions. The most obvious of the errors entitling Brian to relief is the trial court's failure to substantially comply with Rule 402d3. The rule is clear that where the court has not concurred in a plea agreement, it should inform the defendant in open court at the time the agreement is stated, that it is not bound by the agreement, and that if the defendant persists in his plea, the disposition may be different than that contemplated by the agreement. But instead of admonishing Brian that it was not bound by the agreement at the time the plea was presented, or even in response to Brian explicitly asking if the sentence could be more than the cap, the court waited until after accepting Brian's plea to tell him that it was not bound by the cap and that the sentencing range was 12 to 120 years. And even then, it never explained that Brian was had the opportunity to persist in or withdraw his plea. An error that was compounded by Brian's attorney incorrectly advising him that he could not withdraw his plea until after he was sentenced. The Fifth District recently highlighted the importance of complying with Rule 402d3 in People v. Strawbridge. The defendant in Strawbridge pled guilty to an amended charge in exchange for a 45-year cap. The trial court did not explicitly agree with or conditionally agree with the cap. The defendant was then sentenced to 45 years. However, his motion to withdraw indicated he believed he would receive a 20-year sentence. When the appellate court found that the trial court's statement that the state is agreeing to a sentencing cap of 45 years, therefore the possible penalties would be a sentence of 20 to 45 years, could have reflected that the court assented to be bound by the cap because the maximum penalty without the cap would have been 60 years. But the trial court never clearly and directly indicated its agreement to the cap. So the defendant pled guilty without the court's assurance it would not impose a longer sentence. Strawbridge reiterated that no defendant should be required to make presumptions as to the sentence he is facing, and that it is incumbent on the court to explicitly state its concurrence or conditional concurrence to a plea agreement. Even though the defendant was sentenced within the cap and didn't even raise this issue on appeal, the Fifth District still found the error occurred. The importance of Rule 402d3 is even more deeply underscored by the facts of this case, where Brian asked whether or not he could be sentenced beyond the 33-year cap and was still not told he could be until after his guilty plea was accepted, and where he was never advised that he could withdraw his plea after learning The court was not bound by the agreement before he was sentenced to a term of 120 years, 87 years more than he thought he had agreed to. As a consequence of the court's failure to properly admonish Brian, he was left to make presumptions as to whether he was facing a 33-year sentence or a 120-year sentence at the time the court asked him if he pled guilty or not guilty. Brian's third post-plea motion indicated that if he had known he did not have to persist in his plea, he would have withdrawn the plea and proceeded to trial. Because the court's failure to adequately admonish Brian pursuant to Rule 402d3 failed to fulfill the purpose of Rule 402 in ensuring Brian's plea was voluntary, the plea should be vacated and the matter remanded for him to have the opportunity to plead anew. Trial court failure to admonish Brian consistent with Rule 402d3 also contributed to Brian pleading guilty while under multiple misapprehensions that rendered the plea involuntary. First, Brian incorrectly believed—
Morning, counsel. Excuse me.
Morning.
On the request that you're making with regards to remand, one of the other issues that you've raised in the brief is the request of reassignment to another judge. And what in the record specifically, you've mentioned a variety of factors, but what really requires remand in this instance that is supported by the record to be sent to another judge in the event that the court would agree with your argument?
Your Honor, if the court agrees to remand the matter, we believe a new judge should be assigned to the case because the judge here maxed Brian out. He sentenced him to 120 years and abused his discretion in doing so. The court found that that Brian had not expressed remorse. And as the record show, Brian explicitly explicitly accepted responsibility 5 different times. But the court apparently didn't find that that was sufficient remorse and sufficiently accepting responsibility. And in our opinion, the trial court abused its discretion in the sentence to the extent that a new judge would be required. It did not consider Brian's criminal history appropriately in mitigation. The court held the Brian's traffic tickets against him. He had approximately an average of, I believe, one traffic ticket every 2 years since like the mid 90s. His prior offenses were primarily misdemeanor property crimes. The court also didn't consider the hardship that would be imposed on his family. Brian cared for his disabled brother. He was purchasing his brother's home. He had actually 2 disabled brothers and he assisted his elderly mother in caring for them. He provided financial support. He also assisted in taking his brothers to things like doctor's appointments. I believe at least one of them was a stroke victim. I think they maybe both had diabetes. One of them for sure was in a wheelchair, and that's the one.
Counsel, let me interrupt you. Are you saying then, in response to Justice Lannert's question, that this court, should we remand this in order to have a new judge appointed, that you have to demonstrate that Judge Workman abused his discretion in handing down the sentence that he imposed?
No, Your Honor, not necessarily.
Is there a way for us to do that short of finding an abuse of discretion on the part of the trial court?
Yes, Your Honor, I think the court can assign the case to a new judge. It doesn't necessarily require an abuse of discretion in—
Okay, I appreciate that you think that, but is there some authority for that?
Your Honor, I apologize. I don't have that right in front of me at this moment. But in the event this court does not think that the case should be remanded for Brian to withdraw his plea, it should vacate the order denying his post-plea motion or remand for him to be able to file new post-plea motions, including a motion to reconsider sentence. Brian's ability to challenge his sentence hinges on whether a partially negotiated plea qualifies as a negotiated plea for purposes of Rule 604D, where the trial court does not concur in or accept the plea agreement and sentences the defendant vastly beyond the agreed terms. Our Supreme Court's interpretation of the rule shows that it does not. In Evans, the court relied on contract principles and the concept of fundamental fairness in holding the defendant can't challenge a sentence following a fully negotiated guilty plea, because that would amount to seeking to hold the state to its end of the deal while unilaterally changing the sentence the defendant agreed to. Then in Linder, the court addressed the same issue, a similar issue of whether a defendant who pled guilty in exchange for a cap on the length of his sentence may challenge a sentence within the cap without first moving to withdraw his plea, finding that by agreeing to plead guilty in exchange for a recommended sentencing cap, a defendant is, in effect, agreeing not to challenge any sentence imposed below that cap on the grounds that it's excessive. Then next in Lundy, the Supreme Court found that even where charges are dismissed, if there's no agreement as to sentencing, the defendant did not have to withdraw his plea to challenge the sentence, noting that when the state does not provide any sentence inducement for a defendant in its plea bargain, such a negotiated plea, at least for purposes of the sentencing hearing, more closely resembles an open plea, and that the trial court retains all of its discretion at sentencing. Later in Heider, where the defendant pled guilty in exchange for a 6-year cap, but received the 10-year sentence and challenged his sentence as excessive, alleging the trial court considered an improper factor at sentencing, the Supreme Court remanded for resentencing without discussing whether the defendant's challenge was proper under Rule 604D. The state suggests that the state appellate prosecutor, 3 justices on this court, the assistant attorney general, 7 justices on the Supreme Court, and all of the clerks and staff attorneys that looked at that case along the way somehow mysteriously missed the fact that the defendant was improperly challenging his sentence following a negotiated plea. The more logical explanation is that this went without comment because it was obvious to everyone involved that the trial court sentencing the defendant to almost 2 times the agreed cap under Rule 604D, that did not prohibit him from challenging his sentence because the plea was functionally an open plea. Then in Johnson, the Supreme Court reinforced its finding in Linder that a defendant who is sentenced under an agreed cap cannot challenge his sentence as excessive because he has agreed to accept any sentence under that agreed cap. The cases finding that a sentence following a partially negotiated plea cannot be challenged all addressed cases where the sentence was below the cap. The time the court was faced with a plea involving a sentence above the cap, the matter of whether or not he could challenge that sentence under Rule 604D was not raised. But after finding error with the sentencing hearing, the court reversed and remanded for resentencing. Consistent with that, when the Fifth District was faced with such a situation involving a plea where the sentence was above the cap, in Honor, the defendant was sentenced to 10 years despite the state recommending 4. And the Fifth District agreed that because the court rejected the state's recommendation, the sentencing procedure transformed into a hearing more akin to an open plea, which allowed the defendant to challenge her sentence without withdrawing the plea. In Honor, the defendant signed a plea agreement acknowledging the court did not participate in the agreement and was not bound by the recommendation. And the court also admonished the defendant it was not bound by the agreement. And then the state asked the court to reconfirm the defendant still wanted to persist in her guilty plea. And the court asked if she had changed her mind, and the defendant said no. She was then admonished again about the court not being bound by the agreement at her sentencing hearing. And although the state upheld its bargain by recommending the agreed upon sentence, the trial court rejected that recommendation. And once the trial court indicated it was rejecting the negotiated sentence, the procedure converted into a hearing more like an open plea where the court could exercise its full discretion. Because the proceedings became analogous to a sentencing proceedings following an open plea, the defendant's sentence exceeded the scope of the negotiated plea, and the court found it could consider the defendant's sentencing argument, even though she abandoned her claim that she was entitled to withdraw her plea. The state in that case, after considering the evidence and the defendant's conduct since the incident, determined that society's interest in punishing the defendant was satisfied by a 4-year sentence and strongly advocated for her to receive that sentence, which undermines any conclusion that the defendant posed so serious a future threat that the maximum sentence was required to protect the public. And likewise here, Brian's plea transformed into an open plea when the court sentenced him to 87 years over the state's 33-year recommendation and imposed the maximum sentence of 120 years. Like the defendant in Honor, Brian should be permitted to challenge his sentence.
I want to ask a question for a moment.
Yes, Your Honor.
You mentioned discretion. Well, doesn't the trial court in the negotiated or partially negotiated plea exercise its discretion? It can give less than what the state is recommending. It can give what the state is recommending, or it can give more than what the state is recommending. Is there something wrong with that statement? It has full discretion to do whatever.
Your Honor, I apologize. I'm not sure I'm understanding the question. Yes, the court would have.
You said that the court exercised its full discretion in sentencing to far beyond the cap or the agreed upon recommendation. My suggestion is the court exercises its full discretion regardless, because it doesn't have to give what the state recommends. It can give less, can give the same, or it can give more. So I don't understand how stating that the court gets to exercise its full discretion has anything to do with whether or not this gets converted to an open plea.
Your Honor, in a fully negotiated plea, the court would not be exercising, it would exercise discretion in accepting the plea, but it wouldn't exercise its discretion in having the full range of sentencing options available to it. It would sentence the defendant to the proposed plea.
But when it's partially negotiated, the court continues to have full discretion.
Yes, Your Honor. I apologize, I didn't hear that last part.
If it's a partially negotiated plea, the court continues to have full discretion.
Yes,
the only way the discretion is taken away is in a fully negotiated plea and the court accepts it, other than the discretion to accept it.
Yeah, I think what you're getting at is it ties back into the problem with Mr. Williams not being admonished under Rule 402D3.
I don't necessarily disagree, but I'm challenging you on, it appears to me as if you think that because it was so far above the sentencing recommendation, that's what turns it into, or what really ought to grab our attention.
Your Honor, yeah, I do think because it was so extreme that this can't possibly be what the Supreme Court intended to consider a negotiated plea that a defendant can't challenge under Rule 604D. But even if it had only been 1 year over, 2 years over, anything that's exceeding that cap is outside the scope of what the defendant agreed to. And it doesn't go against the contract principles that Evans and its progeny are talking about, that when the defendant is not getting what he bargained for, particularly in a situation here where he doesn't know that, so the record shows that he was asking about it during the plea, he didn't know it was an option. In a situation like that, particularly under our facts where he doesn't know, where he wasn't admonished, it functions as an open plea where the court was not concurring in or agreeing to the cap. I think Honor is a really good example of that, where even though the defendant there did know that the court was not bound by it, the Fifth District found that it was still function as an open plea because the court didn't stay within the cap. And that's what transforms it into an open plea, where the court is not accepting the agreement. The court's functionally rejecting the plea agreement that is presented. And that's what turns it into an open plea. And I think treating it that way is still, it's consistent with cases like Evans. Because here it actually would create like the reverse situation of allowing the state to receive the benefit of its bargain, obtaining convictions without having to present a case at trial, while the defendant receives essentially no true benefit from having relinquished his right to trial. And in a case like this, where had he gone to trial and faced 120 or assuming all three charges 135 years, there's no true benefit to him to pleading and presenting an open plea for a situation like that. What would he gain from that? It's because he was enticed to doing it by the 33-year cap that gives him that benefit from it. And the record here shows that it functioned as an open plea once the court rejected that agreement and didn't concur in it. Before we put a stamp of approval on a case where the maximum sentence of 120 years was imposed, despite the fact that there was a 33-year sentencing cap, we need to be confident that Brian's plea was knowing and voluntary. Even with the other errors, the fact that Brian pled guilty without knowing he was subject to a sentence of up to 120 years, regardless of that 33-year cap that enticed him to plead guilty, and then received the maximum penalty 87 years beyond the cap, prevents this plea from being voluntarily made. And that happened because the court didn't comply with Rule 402d3. Brian's a layperson. He did not finish high school. He may have some intellectual disabilities, and he was represented by counsel who obviously was not clear on the state of the law. Brian was asking questions from his first court appearance through his sentencing hearing, trying to understand what was happening. And he wasn't receiving clear answers before his plea was accepted. And on top of that, we know he was getting bad legal advice. The record in this case demonstrates that the plea was not knowingly and voluntarily made. If there are no further questions, because Brian did not voluntarily plead guilty, we are asking that the case be reversed and remanded. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Shaver. You will have rebuttals. And now we will hear from Mr. Nicolosi, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Ms. Shaver. My name is Justin Nicolosi. I represent the state of Illinois in this matter. And the state submits requests this court to affirm the defendant's convictions and sentences. The state is at the outset is going to kind of acknowledge that the trial court here did not strictly comply with a rule 402d3. There's obviously no question that the court did not explicitly parrot the language in that rule. Of course, the state submits that the court does not need to strictly comply with the language in that rule. The state submits that the court did substantially comply based on a review of the transcript in this case. The state observes that there is no question based on the transcript and the proceedings below that this was a recommended sentencing cap that the state had agreed to. There should be no question what the word recommend means. It means that the person who was being recommended this 33-year cap does not have to agree to it. It's not required. That was made crystal clear at the guilty hearing in this case. The defendant.
Counsel, what was crystal clear?
This was just a recommendation from the state. This was not a requirement. This was not an ironclad 33-year.
That became crystal clear only after the court had accepted the guilty plea, right?
But crystal clear in that the court only expressly used the terminology after accepting the guilty plea. I would agree with that. But it should have been crystal clear that the word recommend, what the word recommended means. That's not a Ms. Shaver talked about how he's a layperson, he didn't finish high school, but everybody knows what the word recommend means. It means that the judge in this case was not required to accept for 3 years. The state says there should be no debate on that point. That defendant who stated in court that he understood the agreement, he signed off on the agreement, therefore he knew that this cap was just merely a recommendation.
Mr. Nicolosi, I note Ms. Shaver in her reply brief indicated that the state had not responded to the Collins case. I hope you saw that in the reply brief. What is your response to the Collins case?
Your Honor, I regret to inform you, I was having some technical issues here and I was not able to access my favorite. I apologize that I did not have response to that.
Could you repeat that? You broke up on me. I didn't hear all.
Oh, I'm
that.
Sorry. My response is I had technical issues and I was not able to access Ms. Shaver's reply brief. If this court would like, certainly I will try to get a hard copy of her reply brief and respond in a brief after argument if this court would appreciate that.
Well, in her reply brief, she cited the case of, she cited in her initial brief, pointed out in the reply brief that the state did not respond to People v. Collins. Are you familiar with the case? If you're not, that's okay.
But I apologize, Your Honor, I am not.
Okay.
At this point, yeah. I'm sure when I wrote the brief, I was, but in my preparation for our argument, that's not a case I received. I apologize.
Okay. Proceed.
Your Honor, well, the case that I focused on in my brief and I think is relevant here is People versus Myers. It's a third district case where the court, the third district, stressed that strict liability or strict requirement with 402D3 is not required by a trial judge. The court in that case, the trial court stated that informed the defendant clearly that it could sentence the defendant to whatever it saw fit. It rattled off several different examples of sentences that the court would impose, for example, 2 to 6 years and 5 to 15 years, a bunch of different examples. Third District, based on that record, stated that the concepts established in 402D3, the concepts that are required to be imparted upon the defendant were met in that case. And the state submits that here, the trial court similarly met those requirements.
Excuse me, counsel. What in the record shows that the defendant knew that he had the right to withdraw the plea if the court did not concur? And isn't it significant in this case that those statements were all made after the defendant had pled guilty?
Yes, Your Honor, I cannot certainly hide from the fact that the court basically strictly complied with the rule after entering judgment on the plea. But the state submits that the fact that the court did in its admonishments before accepting did inform the defendant that he had the option of continuing with his not guilty plea, which he had up to that point, of course, continued with, but that the defendant also had the option to be guilty. I think that, you know, based on the court's language and its proper admonishment on that point, the defendant knew that he had the ability to continue with his not guilty plea, or he had the option of pleading guilty. He ended up doing it. Your Honors, the fact that the state submits to the fact that the defendant during the court's admonishments of future consequences of his plea and so forth, that the defendant essentially volunteered with a question that he asked if he could get more than the cap. And the state submits that was not responsive to anything the court said. The defendant kind of came up with that on his own.
Well, excuse me, counsel. In fact, wasn't that responsive to what I will say the general admonishments where we talk about possible consequences of the plea and that any future conviction may have an increased sentence? In his mind, he had not yet pled guilty. Isn't it arguable, at least, that that language is what made him become concerned that he could have gotten more from the cap?
I understand that argument, and that certainly could be a defendant's position on that. But the state submits that, given the fact that the current issue on appeal is whether or not the sentence would go over on the cap, the state would argue that that was a topic or a question that was put in his mind by defense counsel. Of course, that's not on the record. That's just the state's supposition here. It kind of gets to the fact later in my brief that I argued this isn't really the right forum for an ineffective assistance argument, because we don't know exactly what defense counsel instructed defendant about this plea before we got on the record here in court. State submits the fact that that question was on the defendant's mind. State submits that certainly was, it's possible that counsel discussed the fact that this was a partially negotiated plea and that this was a recommended sentence for the defendant. You know, let's say it's just submitting here for the sake of argument, the defendant knew this was a recommended sentence. So he calculated what that meant and asked the court kind of at a time he saw fit, asking the court whether or not he can get more than the cap. And that's the state's argument based on the record that we have here in this case. And the court said in response to the defendant asking if he could get more than the cap, that we'll discuss that later. Again, the state acknowledges that's not the perfect way to this Supreme Court rule and that particular question by defendant. Proper mode would have been to, at that point, to lay out the rule and the law at that point in as clear as possible. Was not done in this case, but the state submits that based on the question defendant asked, the fact that we're talking about a recommended sentence, defendant knew we were talking about a recommended cap, and based on the precedent in Myers where very similar language was used to express the concepts in 403, that this court find that the court actually comply with. If the court, moving on, the court, the state submits that the court did not further did not deny or abuse its discretion in denying defendant's claim that his was involuntary. The state or the defense argues that there were several misapprehensions that were in that caused defendant to go down the road to plead guilty. State submits that while the guilty plea hearing, the defendant mentioned many different random things, such as the dates, such as it was his only option, that was a quote, and other things that the defense points to as contributing to the argument that his he was involuntary. The state submits all of those statements, as I argue at length in my brief, do not point to defendant's plea being involuntary. Trial court admonished the defendant about charges he was facing, the maximum penalties he was facing. The defendant said he wasn't forced or coerced. He wanted to plead guilty based on the totality of what the trial court did in this case. The state submits that this court should find that court properly denied defendant's motion to withdraw his based on it being involuntary. Moving on to the final issue, the state submits that the defendant should not be able to appeal an issue based on his sentence. This court's very recent decision in Robinson, the state submits, is on point with this case, and this court should follow Robinson, where it seemed like that the state would surmise that this court kind of reluctantly went ahead and issued its Robinson, even though, yeah, clearly the agreement that was entered into was just a cap, but the court wasn't bound by it. But the court found it technically it was a negotiated plea because the prosecutor had bound itself to recommend a specific sentence based on that language. This was a negotiated plea based on 604D. Therefore, even though the court didn't have to agree with that, by the letter of the law, it was a negotiated guilty plea. Therefore, this court in Robinson found that it had to abide by the rule that the only recourse in this for a negotiated guilty plea is to withdraw your plea and vacate the judgment. And can't just go forward with it. Also, the state submits that if this court does find error occurred and decides to remand the matter, the state submits that Judge Workman should not be replaced in this case. The reason for imposing the sentence that Judge Workman did, the bases are all based on things that happened in this case, based on defendants that the horrendous crimes were committed, based on the defendant's criminal record, based on the statements defendant made in allocution, where the defendant basically stopped short of accepting responsibility and multiple instances tried to suggest that the victim was. So based on those, that was why Judge Workman sentenced the defendant as he did. The judge did not use any outside of the record influences, and based on that, there's no basis with which to point at the Judge Workman for having some sort of prejudice bias against isn't based on the fact in this case. So with that, that's all I have. If there are any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
I have a question, Mr. Nicolosi. Yes. Based on the what your last argument, that the state's position, should we remand this case, is that the same trial judge would be allowed to proceed. What if the state on remand doesn't really want to have to put the victim on to testify and really wants a plea agreement, and the defendant also wants to do a plea agreement? How could that ever occur? Because this trial court, it's still in front of this trial judge, has already sentenced the defendant to the maximum. And so defendant's not going to plead guilty. On an open plea of any kind, because he already knows he's going to get the maximum. But the state actually does want to do a plea agreement with the defendant. Isn't, I believe your client, or not your client, I believe defendant is 50 years old. The state very well may have thought the 33-year sentence was sufficient, and defendant was willing to agree with it. And now that would be off the table. So my question is, why is it that the state takes the position that the same trial judge should be involved on remand? Because it seems to me maybe to be counterproductive to what the state might want to do.
I understand that, Your Honor. And to your point, you just made that if it got remanded and the defendant was in front of Justice Workman, and he would get the max. I believe you kind of suggested he would get the max if this same situation unfolded below. The state disagrees with that particular statement, because if you look at the record in this case, the reason, a strong reason why the defendant received the maximum was because of his statements and allocution regarding the victim, that the judge took those strongly into consideration. The state believes if this went back and defendant either pled guilty or was found guilty again, and he was able to make a statement, perhaps the defendant after this process and the time has passed, maybe he has reconsidered his thoughts on this matter and would be much more willing to accept all the blame, because of course he deserves all the blame for what happened. And the state submits that if the defendant provided Judge Workman, an ability to give a lesser sentence by being remorseful, then Justice Workman would, or Judge Workman would do so. The judge would probably give a lesser sentence if the defendant kind of provided the judge an opportunity to do that. I hope that answered your question. If there are any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
I don't see any other questions, so thank you for your argument. Ms. Shaver, do you have any rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. First, while an attorney might understand that the word recommendation meant that the court wasn't bound by the agreement, a layperson who has not gone through past their sophomore year in high school, who has trouble reading and writing, has never been to prison before, and for 20 or more than 20 years hadn't been involved in the criminal justice system, wouldn't necessarily understand that the court didn't have to follow that recommendation. Regarding People v. Myers, I don't think that case is really comparable to what happened here. The defendant in Myers was admonished twice about the fact that the court would determine the sentence before the pleas were accepted, and provided multiple detailed examples of what types of sentences could be imposed. And even though the admonishment given in that case wasn't verbatim what the rule provided, it still substantially complied, because an ordinary lay person would have understood, based on what was said, that the court had the ability to fashion a sentence with the broader range. And here, Brian was not told that he could be sentenced up to 120 years, despite the fact that he had agreed to a 33-year cap with the state, until after he pled guilty. So this case is more like Collins. Myers is just completely distinguishable. Also, complying with Rule 402A and admonishing Brian consistent with that, that's not a substitute for substantially complying with Rule 402D3. Those requirements were listed out by the Supreme Court separately for a reason. Even if Brian's question about being able to be sentenced beyond the cap had just been a clarifying point because he already knew that the cap wasn't binding. Again, I think the way the question is posed suggests that it was an inquiry rather than a confirmation. But even if it was just a confirmation, that the question is still essentially asking the court if it is going to concur in the plea agreement with the agreed cap. And Strawbridge says that a defendant, the court needs to provide clear and direct indication if it is. So failing to answer that question is still a problem with 402D3, even if it was just seeking clarification of something that Brian was already aware of. And again, we don't think it was. I think Justice Turner's points concerning Brian's ability to plead guilty before Judge Workman, if the case was remanded, being in front of that judge would have a chilling effect on the party's ability to resolve the matter without going to trial. And under the facts of this case, it seems that that is something the parties both would be interested in trying to accomplish.
Let me stop you there. You say we have a chilling effect. Suppose we agree with you on that. Is that a basis for this court to, upon remand, direct that a new judge be assigned to the matter?
Yeah, I think it is. The purpose of being able to remand before another judge is to ensure that the proceedings are fair, that it would be a fair hearing, plead guilty or not guilty either way. And in this case, bias has been presented, we believe, on a record, and that does necessitate.
Now, wait a minute. Wait. We could do this without saying there's been bias. We could do it in the interest, or could we do it in the interest of the administration of justice?
Yes, Your Honor.
But okay, then why are you asking this? I understand that's a separate issue, but to base it on bias that he's shown, then we don't need to consider the administration of justice. And I understand your point about it, but it seems to me that you want it, but you want to blame him for showing bias, and you want to say, well, we also couldn't ever get a fair plea.
Yeah, I think that those two issues are interconnected. It's the judge that has exhibited the bias that prevents Brian from being able to fairly go to trial or present a new plea. If the parties came up with a new agreement, the court has made it clear that it's not accepting a negotiated agreement from these parties. And that prevents either way what happens on remand, the matter from being fair. And that is the purpose of being able to assign to a new judge. Because Brian did not voluntarily plead guilty, in part due to the inadequate of admonishments as required by 402D, we are asking this court to reverse the trial court's order denying his motion to withdraw his plea and remand the matter for further proceedings. Thank you.
Okay, thanks to both of you. The case is submitted and the court now stands in recess.